Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today we have a very special episode. We're going to be talking about secondary triage. We're going to be talking about the emergency communication nurse system, and we'll get to what those are in a couple of minutes. But first, I'd like to introduce who we have with us today. The first is Dr. Conrad Fivaz. He is the director of the emergency communication nurse system. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Hi, Isabel. Thank you for having us on your talk this afternoon. My background, I'm a family physician, trained in South Africa, worked in emergency department, worked on the Flights for Life helicopter service, and a few years in England as a family physician. And in 1998, I got involved with a group of physicians from Harvard and Stanford University, and we looked at nurse triage protocols, and that was the birth of the secondary triage system. We're going to talk about more today.
Okay, thanks. We also have Gigi Marshall, who is a registered nurse and has a lot of background in nurse training. So can you give us a little bit of background on yourself?
Sure. I graduated back in 1988 with my Bachelor of Science in Nursing. Most of my career was spent in an emergency department. I've ran two emergency departments, an ICU, disaster preparedness, then got my master's and taught as an assistant professor of nursing for 9 years. I joined PSI, Priority Solutions, Inc., back 2.5 years ago, and was hired as the program administrator.
Great. So what we're talking about today may not be familiar to everybody who works in a dispatch center. We're talking about something called secondary triage or nurse triage, which is a program by which calls that end up at the lower acuity or lower severity end of the dispatching scale, the lower priority levels, can go out for additional triage by a nurse. So, Conrad, can you just give us a little bit of an idea of what's the purpose of secondary triage? Why would we do this and how does it work?
Yeah. So we get our regular calls into 911, patients phone, and they would typically expect an ambulance to show up. Some of those calls are classified as non-urgent or low acuity, depending on which code in the 911 triage system has been reached. So if they reach a low acuity code or non-urgent code, that call is then transferred to a nurse that will do a more in-depth clinical triage process. Triage means to sort or to sift, and in effect, ask more questions about your condition and try and look for alternative places to send you other than the emergency department.
Okay, then one of the purposes would be perhaps to divert some people who call 911 or 999 or whatever the emergency number is from accessing care through an ambulance or from going to an emergency department. Is that right?
Well, not exactly.
Okay.
When you say divert, that almost sounds like that is our purpose and our goal. What we're trying to do is get the most appropriate care.
Okay.
Not everyone who calls needs an ambulance or needs an emergency department. So what that nurse is doing is using our protocol set to determine if it would be safe and more efficient to be handled in another way.
That's a great distinction then. So the purpose of secondary triage isn't to try to gatekeep or keep people out of the system. It's actually to find a more appropriate level or type of care for them.
That's correct.
Correct.
We're not considered a barrier to access to care.
Right.
But to actually facilitate access to care, because the patients and callers that call don't always know of other alternatives that's available for their specific conditions.
Hmm. So tell us a story about who are these patients? What kinds of conditions are they calling with? What kinds of care do they need to access? Why are they calling 911 or 999 for these kinds of calls?
Well, one of the more common conditions that end up being processed by the nurse is, for example, abdominal pain. And typically, abdominal pain isn't going to be emergent. It is painful, though, and they do want to be seen. So that is one of the protocols that's accessed more frequently than others that the nurse will process. Sometimes you do get an abdominal pain that may be something more emergent, and they still may need a 911 disposition. But very often, as we ask the questions and start to think about how soon this really needs to be seen and if it can even be done with some self-care instructions, then we might be able to help them to arrive at a different level of care and a different level of service.
One of the things that's been interesting in the research that we've done and in looking at ECNS has been that these tend to be much longer triage situations. So in when we think of 911, when we think of 999 or these other emergency systems, we think of this time pressure for triage. But once we've identified them as being lower in severity, there's a little bit more time to delve into the problem. Can you maybe, Conrad, give us a typical call? So what kinds of things are they looking for? What are they walking through during that time?
Yes. So typically, as you mentioned, your 911 calls are time critical. If we find that patients have certain key symptoms present, we want to make sure that we get an ambulance to them fairly rapidly. In those low acuity conditions where your primary triage system or your initial screening indicated that this patient have a low acuity or less urgent condition, the nurse have more time to delve into this in a bit more detail. So our protocols are a little bit longer. There's more questions to cover. And typically a call will last anything from about 8 to 15 minutes. And this depends on certain alternatives that's available for this patient in their community, how long it takes this nurse to actually get to those alternative dispositions. Items that we typically look for is the chief complaint. Mm-hmm. What's this patient complaining about? What is their symptom? So say, for example, they're complaining about a headache. We would ask more questions about their current medical conditions, their allergies, any medications they're currently taking, because those will impact the symptom that they're calling with. For example, a patient can be calling with a headache, but be on warfarin. And I'm sure you're all familiar with what warfarin is.
Mm-hmm.
And a patient with a certain type of headache or presenting with a headache that came on suddenly all at once like a thunderclap, and they're also using warfarin, there's some red flags, red lights being activated for the nurse.
And just to make sure everybody knows what that is warfarin, it's a blood thinning medication, is that correct?
Okay. It's an anti-clotting agent. So we would try and exclude these conditions in conjunction with current medications and also current medical conditions. For example, hypertension, diabetes, and any other conditions that might be present. And then we'll start asking questions of less urgency. So you can see there's a hierarchy of urgency in the type of questions we ask, so that if this patient is harboring a more serious condition, we'll pick up on it early and not waste any time to respond to this patient. Should those initial questions be answered in the negative, then we'll ask more questions and more questions that's asked, and we got negative answers to those or no answers to those, it's less likely that this patient is harboring a serious condition.
You're screening out those potentially more serious conditions right at the beginning and then moving down the list from there.
It's a very accurate summary. And you're hitting the nail on the head there in terms of the fact that we're trying to exclude the presence of certain conditions. We're not trying to make a diagnosis for this specific patient. That's why it's called triage. We try and sort this patient to the most appropriate recommended care level rather than to put a label on this patient as a specific diagnosis.
And that's how it's similar to the work of the EMDs in the 911 center, that is more about triage than diagnosis.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Then let me bring up a question that I know has been a point of debate among some people looking at the emergency communication nurse system, which is does it have to be a nurse? And if so, why does it have to be a nurse? I mean, some people have argued that secondary triage can be performed by either a trained layperson like an EMD or by a paramedic, by an EMT. Why a nurse?
They were designed, actually, with a nurse in mind. And the difference between the training in nursing and the training in, say, a paramedical field, traditionally there's been a large gap between the training. Nursing is more of a case management sort of training, where the paramedicine training was more of a, what are you doing with this one thing right now to load up and go? Where the nurse is more of a start to finish, how do you take care of the patient? Some of the training now with community paramedicine is beginning to look at more of a chronic and long-term sort of care for the patient. It is in its infancy, but there may be a time that the two disciplines can be walked across and can be considered to be comparable. But for now, I believe we've got probably one of the most robust triage systems in the world for secondary purposes. In addition to looking at the incoming information that comes into the nurse, like the medications, the confounding illnesses, the social needs, in doing case management, the nurse is also required at the end to give instructions and teaching. So it's very important that that person is well-versed in discharge planning and more of a long-term sort of view on the patient. And nurses have that, most of them, in their training. A lot of us have worked in hospitals, and we are used to setting them up then for the next phase.
I like that because it reminds us that this kind of nursing triage is about extending patient care beyond just the moment of the call and making sure that they continue to get what they need. And in fact, if I'm not wrong, I think some of these systems do follow-up calls. They keep in touch with the patient over the next few days. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they can even develop a care plan for that patient so that when someone's using the system much, they'll have a very complete record of what's gone on.
So you also ask why we can't just use a layperson to do this type of medicine. And it's important to realize that a clinical background, similar to what a nurse has been taught at university or college, is really important because that nurse have to triangulate a lot of information, clinical information, as we mentioned earlier, the comorbids, which is other conditions the patient might be suffering from, medications the patient is using. And then the nurse have to come up with a management plan and use clinical judgment in the decision. I always use the analogy that the algorithms or protocols is like a very good stethoscope. We're selling a very good stethoscope, but it needs a very good clinician to effectively apply that stethoscope. So stethoscope, you can, with a good stethoscope, you can listen to heart murmurs and you can pick up on certain sounds, which you will not be able to interpret without the clinical knowledge and experience. And this is why we use nurses, because they have this clinical experience to actually use these protocols very effectively and apply them to come to a safe and effective triage endpoint.
That's interesting. So even I could probably sit down with the system and ask questions and get answers to the questions, but I wouldn't necessarily be able to analyze the responses that I'm getting from the caller and then make the correct assignment or decision based on that.
That's correct. The nurses cannot be on autopilot. They've got to be actively engaged in the call in order to look at if different variables influence their index of suspicion for something to maybe be more concerning than it might appear because of some outside variables outside of the protocol questions.
And in particular, those maybe other conditions or the medications that the person is already on, those other things that might impact how they're feeling now.
That's right. It might even be something like their other disabilities they may have. If they've got an inability to ambulate well, that's going to change how they're going to maybe get to whatever the alternative disposition is.
So you talk about alternative disposition, and as far as I am aware, alternative disposition means a point of care, a place that they can access care that's not the emergency department. What are some of those other alternate points of care?
It's also not just alternative point of care, but also maybe alternative way in getting there.
Okay.
So alternative disposition might be something like an urgent care center, urgent visit with your primary care physician. It might be that you need to go to emergency department, but it's safe for you to go via your own transport. Alternative transport measures, for example, Lyft or Uber or taxi,
right?
Other than a very expensive and limited resource, in this case, an ambulance.
It sounds then like one of the keys to implementing this system is making sure that there are enough alternatives to make it worth doing. So there has to be some sort of other system in place, because I know one of the things that we hear a lot is people access the emergency department because they have no other options. So there have to be other options for this to work. So how do you go about working with an agency that wants to implement this to make sure that that network of other points of care is available?
Well, you're exactly right. The community resources will help to drive the success of a program. And it really does vary among agency to agency what's available out in the community. We've got templates that are available from other agencies and different resources they've used. And also our agencies that are current clients have been very willing to speak with and help our other clients in the development of a directory of service.
Yeah, they also involve the stakeholders in the community early on during a stakeholders meeting, where they discuss potential alternatives to the emergency department and transferring patients via ambulance. And many of these early stakeholder meetings we have at potential clients, they involve the community in a huge way, not just the hospital systems, the primary care systems, urgent care systems, but also the funders of healthcare to be present at these meetings.
So then tell me, if I were in the center and I'm thinking about implementing this, or I'm in charge of figuring out whether this is going to work for us, what do I have to do? Do I have to go out and actually talk to people at the hospitals? Do I have to go to every urgent care in my area? Do I have to, you know, make sure I get funding for this? What is my role in implementing this?
Well, typically when someone has an interest, the first thing they do is reach out to Conrad and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And we start to look at their data. We look at their numbers, because there is a certain number of calls that need to be coming in order for this to be feasible. And from that, we can extrapolate which of those calls in the year before would have met ECNS eligible criteria.
And this relates to the study also that the two of you looked at a couple of years ago, which we can link to in the show notes, that looked not only at do we have enough volume of these low acuity calls to make it worth implementing the system, but what's our risk level? So we wanted to make sure that sending certain types of calls to these alternate points of care or to the secondary triage was low enough in risk to be worth doing. Can you talk us through a little bit on what you did on that study and why?
I think it's a very important question, the question of safety. And that's always a question that come up with a new potential client that will engage in this type of medicine. And for many years, we've known from studies that's been published that the omega level codes are very safe. But there was always the question about the alpha level codes. There were early studies around certain of those alpha level codes, which showed that the majority of them are safe. We then embarked in a study a couple of years ago where we looked at just over 19,000 alpha level codes. Now, the alpha level codes is the next lowest level codes after the omega level codes.
Right.
So the codes are classified from Echo, Delta, Charlie, Bravo, Alpha, Omega in descending order of urgency.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a lot of data on the alpha level codes. So this study would assist us getting to a point where we have some evidence of what's actually happening to these patients that's been classified by the emergency medical dispatchers to be an alpha level coded patient. So we also looked at what was the findings of the paramedics and EMTs that actually went to the scene where this patient was.
Right.
What did they encounter on the scene? Were these patients actually ill patients, or were they really not really urgent patients, patients that needs to be seen urgently in an emergency department?
So every one of these calls that was originally coded by the EMD as an alpha level, you then looked at what was found on the scene to determine whether that would have been safe to take the time for the secondary triage, is that right?
Correct, except for that from the 19,300 odd calls, we found that about 16,700 of them actually had vital sign data.
Okay.
So we then looked at their vital signs, classified them into four categories, from low acuity all the way to high acuity or critical patients. We looked at blood pressure, pulse oximetry. We looked at their Glasgow Coma Scale. And all of these indicators are indicators of how ill a patient could be. What was interesting about this finding is that about 90% of the patients, almost 9 out of every 10 patients, did not have a single indicator that they might have been unstable.
Huh, wow, that's interesting. So it wasn't even just that they didn't match all the criteria for an unstable patient. They didn't have a single indicator.
Correct. And another interesting finding was that the paramedics or EMTs at the scene felt that they only had to transport just over 1%, 1 out of 100 patients urgently to the hospital.
Which is a good validation, because those are the people who can actually see the patient, they can evaluate them, and once they'd seen them and evaluated them, they identified them as not needing any urgent immediate care.
Correct, and that gave us the confidence that the majority of the alpha level codes are in fact safe to pass on for secondary triage for a nurse to further look at these patients. But what it also serves is that for that 1.1% of patients, there will be a safety net where the nurse have opportunity to pick up on a potential unstable patient and upgrade their response to receive a faster response configuration than they would have otherwise had been classified as an alpha level patient.
That's one of the values then of having this system attached to a 911 center, because it's already gone through the 911 triage. If it goes to the nurse identifies it as a higher acuity or potentially more severe call. It can just be sent out as an ambulance through the 911 center if necessary. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Gigi, can you tell us a little bit about what's the response from EMDs in the centers where this is implemented? So if I'm a dispatcher, how does my process change? What's my role in this system?
Well, your role would begin as it usually does, taking in a 911 call and processing the call. If at some point in the questioning, you get to your determination code and it is one of those that have been identified as ECNS eligible, and it's something like 88 alphas and 50-something omegas.
Out of 140 total codes that's considered eligible.
So,
But then the agency can, to some extent, to choose which of those they want to actually
use. The medical director goes over those before they implement and determines which ones they're comfortable beginning use of the ECNS with.
Okay.
Then what would happen with that dispatcher when one of those low acuity ECNS eligible codes is hit is that a pink box comes up on their screens and alerts them with a script that tells the patient that it looks like they would be best served speaking with a nurse at this time to manage their call. And then we'll send it over to the nurse via CAD, and the nurse would then pick it up and begin the low acuity triage.
Important to notice also that, to note that this is actually a warm transfer from the EMD to the nurse, so at no point that patient or caller is left alone waiting to be transferred from one individual to another individual.
So it's not like they'll be stuck on hold for several minutes waiting.
No.
Right.
I think one of the things that the listeners would be interested in hearing is some of the success stories, maybe even for individual patients. What's the kind of situation in which someone has called 911 or 999 or one of these emergency numbers, thinking that they were going to get an ambulance, were transferred to this secondary triage, and then really got what they needed more than being sent to an ambulance. Gigi, do you have an example?
I do. I think actually one of the better examples came from REMSA. And
which is Reno, is that right?
Uh-huh. Okay. It's a Regional Emergency Medical Services Authority. But in their studies, they had one case where someone called in with an injury. I believe it was an ankle. And the ambulance was sent on that call at the same time. Some of our agencies will send ambulances even though a nurse is taking the call as a backup, safety backup measure. But this, the nurse told the patient, oh, you can get a ride into an urgent care center and have it managed. Then the paramedics got on the scene and told her, no, you need to come in the ambulance and we'll ride to the ER. So this patient ended up writing a letter to the editor. And what the patient said, the name of the article was something to the tune of the paramedics need to listen to the nurses. And she said that when she got to the emergency department and they took care of her injured ankle, she asked, could this have been managed in an urgent care center? And the emergency room physician said, absolutely.
And that probably would have been not only cheaper, but easier for everybody involved to access that instead.
That's right. And the only complaint or letter to the editor that they had on the ECNS as they were implementing the program. They were saying they were kind of dreading getting that first, you know, letter to the editor, and it ended up being the only one, and it was at that point, and it was very positive.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
It has been such a pleasure, Isabel.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.